From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The state of Texas defies the world court and its own former governor. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush wants Texas to postpone tonight's scheduled execution of an admitted killer, a Mexican national who was denied his rights under an international treaty. The president says Texas should help the U.S. keep its word and obey the world court in the Netherlands. So far, Governor Rick Perry says no deal. On To the Point, it's about the death penalty, illegal immigration, and U.S. credibility. Could there be blowback for American citizens overseas? On Reporter's Notebook later on, a mother load of gorillas has been found in the Republic of Congo. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again. Warren Alney back with To the Point. The state of Texas is defying President Bush by refusing to halt tonight's scheduled execution of an admitted killer. On To the Point, is Texas subject to international law? Could American citizens face retaliation overseas? What does the case have to do with illegal immigration and opposition to the death penalty? On Reporter's Notebook, scientists have been worried about the extinction of lowland gorillas, but a new population has been discovered alive and well, but still vulnerable. First, this news update. The price of oil and the price of gasoline at the pump are continuing to decline, giving American consumers some unexpected relief. David Hobbs is head of research at Cambridge Energy Research Associates in Massachusetts. David Hobbs, good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much for having me.
The price of oil per barrel at one point was up around $145 not very long ago. Yesterday it was down to $119. What's the cause of that?
I think it's difficult to put one's finger on any individual cause, but inevitably there are a number of different factors that come together and may contribute in some way. I think, for starters, we're seeing declines in consumption in some of the developed economies and even a slowing of the rate of growth in some of the developing economies. And as a result, that mitigation of demand has an effect. In addition, we're seeing additional production coming through from some OPEC countries. And some of the big threats overhanging the market in terms of potential production disruptions seem to be less in the front of people's minds right now. And so I think when you add to that some of the short-term effects like the latest hurricane not necessarily impacting U.S. production, it's easy to see how a number of different factors would combine to bring prices back down from just shy of 150 down to below 120 now.
When you talk about declines in consumption in both developed nations and underdeveloped nations, not just the United States then, where demand has an impact on the world price.
That's right. It's in Western Europe, in fact, gas prices are significantly higher than anything experienced over here in the United States. Partly because of larger consumer taxes. But in many of the producer nations of the Middle East, also some parts of Latin America, prices have been quite heavily subsidized. They are still quite heavily subsidized because those governments can afford those subsidies because it's backed by their own production. But take India as an example, where for many years the administered crude pricing mechanism prevented the actual price of crude being passed through to consumers. The government and indeed the major government-owned oil distributors have been unable to continue to support that level of subsidy, and so prices have risen, and that's causing an amelioration of demand increases. And indeed, even in China, we saw initially probably a symbolic move upwards in prices and the removal of some of those subsidies. It's difficult to imagine that with the Olympics on the horizon, a bigger move would have been made, but it's quite probable that after the Olympics are out the way, we'll see consumers being exposed more to the prices that the rest of us are seeing in the world market.
You said also there was an increase in production. Is that the result of American request? I know President Bush went to Saudi Arabia. Vice President Cheney went there too.
Needless to say, I wasn't in the room to hear what either of them requested, but I think that it's more likely to be the result of investments that were made and programs that were in place long before those visits actually occurred. You've got to remember, the oil business is about incredibly long lead times. You know, people are making decisions today that will have an impact in 5 and even 10 years' time. For example, if some of the areas that are currently not open for drilling were opened up, it's unlikely they would make a significant contribution to production any time in the next 3 to 5 years. But nonetheless, the psychological impact of that, and knowing that the additional contribution from some of those sources was on the horizon, would probably contribute to the psychology of the market.
You mentioned a number of factors, including the weather. There's also politics, of course, and concerns about whether there will be an invasion of Iran and many other things that seem to have an impact on the price of oil. Do you expect it to continue to fluctuate? And if so, is there some likelihood it might drop considerably lower than it is now?
Well, I think that prices of oil have been more volatile in recent years than for a number of years, although always fairly volatile. Swings tend to overstate to the upside and understate to the downside. But again, it's a question of how relevant the short-term price is, because what will ultimately determine consumption patterns will be what people expect prices to be in the future. And there's an incredible recency bias that if people can still remember the pain of paying $4.50 a gallon for gasoline, even if prices drop back to $3 and even below $3 a gallon for gasoline, it's highly unlikely they would forget the possibility and indeed likelihood of returning to those higher levels. And as a result, their decisions on what car to buy or on whether to have oil-fired central heating or whatever will be affected for longer than just the oil price today or what it might be next month.
And although we don't have time to talk about it, perhaps it could affect who they vote for. This has become a major issue, obviously, in the presidential campaign. David Hobbs, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Head of Research, Cambridge Energy Research Associates in Massachusetts. In a moment, Texas defies the world court and the Bush White House. On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
We're not only back with To The Point. Jose Medellin is on death row in Texas, scheduled to die tonight by lethal injection. He admits to the rapes and murders of two teenage girls 15 years ago in Houston. But President Bush has asked Texas to hold on, because Medellin, who was a Mexican national, was not granted certain rights he was entitled to under an international treaty. Dave Montgomery reports for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Dave, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the treaty and what rights it was that Mr. Medellin was deprived of.
The treaty is a 1963 treaty that created the Vienna the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, and essentially what that says is that citizens from any of the 166 participating countries, including the United States, have the right to contact their consulate if they're arrested overseas. And in this case, Mr. Medellin says that he wasn't given that right after his arrest.
Medellin, a Mexican national who grew up in Texas, is that right?
Right. He's lived most of his life in this country, speaks English well, and is accustomed to United States customs. But on the other hand, he's still a Mexican national.
Give our listeners a sense of how brutal this crime was.
It rocked Houston to its core. Two teenage girls, Jennifer Lee Ertman, 14, and Elizabeth Pena, who was 16, were hurrying home from a party when they stumbled into this gang initiation by a gang called the Black and Whites in Houston. And they were raped and murdered. Repeatedly gang raped Medellin, according to testimony, said that he didn't have a gun to kill him. He didn't want to leave witnesses, so he strangled one of the girls with a shoelace.
He has admitted the crime.
Pretty much, although I think, yes, he has, but he is in subsequent instances sought to minimize his involvement in the murders.
In any case, he is a confessed killer. And he is scheduled for execution tonight. Now, at what point did this become an international incident?
Several years ago, in I suppose in 2004, when the International Court of Justice in the Netherlands, it's also known as the World Court, ruled that Medellin and 50 other Mexican nationals on death rows were not given the hearings under the 1963 treaty and therefore were entitled to them. President Bush, a couple of months later in early 2005, ordered the states, Texas and others, to allow these hearings.
And what happened subsequently?
The state of Texas said that in Medellin's case, well, the others too, but focusing on Medellin, said that he's been given his day in court repeatedly. He's grasping this consular access issue in an attempt to save himself to launch a new appeal, and that they refused to grant the hearing.
What did the U.S. Supreme Court say?
The Supreme Court, this has gone through to the Supreme Court twice. The most important ruling was in March when they rejected Medellin's appeal and also ruled that President Bush had overstepped his authority, that he did not have the authority to order Texas to carry out this hearing.
Did the president then continue, though, his request to Texas and other states to hold
this
hearing?
Yes, he has. Both Condoleezza Rice and Attorney General Mukasey have essentially pleaded with the governor to to at least give enough time for Medellin to have his hearing for fear that this is going to cause an international backlash against the United States for ostensibly violating the terms of the treaty. They also point out, not necessarily just them, but others point out that other countries are going to be inclined not to abide by the treaty and possibly retaliate against U.S. citizens who have been arrested overseas.
Dave Montgomery, once again, with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, reports in Washington. That's a McClatchy-owned newspaper. Allison Castle is a spokesperson for the governor of Texas, Rick Perry. And Ms. Castle, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I take it that Dave Montgomery has given us a very good and accurate account of what has taken place. Why is the governor continuing, at least so far, to refuse the president's request?
Well, I think there are a couple things to keep in mind, and first and foremost are the vicious facts of this crime. And the governor continues to say that this is one of the more heinous crimes that have ever come across his desk. These two girls, they stumbled upon a gang initiation that had just happened, and they were, for over an hour, brutally and viciously raped, murdered, and you're right, they said they didn't have a gun, so they strangled them with their very own shoelaces. So it is absolutely a vicious and heinous crime. We don't care where you're from. We welcome people all the time to this state. We encourage people to come to Texas to see all that we have, to experience our wonderful tourist destinations. But the bottom line is, if you commit a despicable crime like this in Texas, you could face the ultimate penalty under our laws.
Well, if the hearings were held, as I understood it, as the president has asked, in order to try to avoid international repercussions, you could still be free and clear to execute Medellin once the hearing was over.
Well, and here's the thing with that, and I think it's also really important to know that this claim of Medellin being harmed by lack of access to consular notification, he didn't tell anyone he was a Mexican national. He didn't bring that up during the trial phase, nor did his lawyers bring it up on appeal. We don't read minds. I mean, certainly it is the responsibility of the individual to let law enforcement and magistrates know that they are a foreign national.
So you're focused then mainly on Medellin as opposed to the concern about international relations.
Absolutely. Texas is not bound by any foreign court's ruling, and American citizens are safe abroad because here in Texas we do provide consular notification. In fact, the Attorney General's office educates law enforcement and magistrates on providing consular notification. So this scare tactic that somehow if Texas moves forward with this that American citizens are going to be somehow unsafe when they visit abroad is silly. Don't go abroad and commit a heinous act like this.
President Bush, Secretary Rice, Attorney General Mukasey are engaged in scare tactics?
Well, I think that the Mexican government is trying to scare people by saying if Texas moves forward with this, that somehow American citizens are going to be at harm abroad. I think that we need to get back to the facts of this case, and you know, we have laws to abide by here in this state. We have a state constitution to abide by, and that's what we're doing.
Allison Castle again speaks for Texas Governor Rick Perry. She'll be with us for a few more minutes. I want to turn now to David Fonte, who's director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. Mr. Fonte, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
My understanding is there's been a warning today by the U.S. ambassador in Mexico City that there could be demonstrations as a result of the execution, if in fact it occurs, and American citizens have been warned to stay away. What do you know about what's liable to happen in Mexico?
Well, I have no particular expertise on what's liable to happen in Mexico, except to note, as you say, that the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City has issued a warning of demonstrations if this execution goes forward and has warned American citizens that they may be at some risk.
What about the merits of the case? Ms. Allison Castle points out that Mr. Medellin has confessed to this case. It's horribly brutal. Texas does have the death penalty. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that it's not subject to international law. Why should the governor postpone this execution?
Well, I think it's important to keep our eye on the real issue here. Obviously, this was a horrifying crime, and obviously Texas has the right to punish people who commit crimes in Texas. No one is here to debate either of those two propositions. But there's a treaty that was violated here, and a court whose jurisdiction the U.S. has accepted has ordered a remedy for that violation. And the issue now is whether the United States is going to keep its word and honor the commitments that it made when it voluntarily ratified this treaty almost 40 years ago.
So you're, again, then, not focusing on Mr. Medellin and the crime so much as you are on the international implications. But the U.S. Supreme Court said that Texas doesn't have to do this if it doesn't want to.
Well, that's not exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court said. The court said very clearly that the world court judgment in the case, it's called the Avena case, constitutes a binding legal obligation on the United States. But it said that domestic legislation is necessary before that judgment can be used in U.S. courts. So all that means is that Mr. Medellin, in his own personal case, as he's appealing his death sentence, can't rely on the Avena judgment in his case. The Supreme Court said nothing at all about Texas not being subject to international law. And in fact, Justice Stevens, who voted with the majority in the case, wrote a whole separate opinion precisely urging Texas to do what Oklahoma did in the same situation and respect the judgment of the world court.
Back to Allison Castle, again, the spokesperson for Governor Perry. Given that aspect, which we didn't hear about before, why hasn't Texas done what Oklahoma did?
Well, you know, I'll tell you that the notion of and what they're trying to do in this process where Medellin's attorneys asked for a 240-day reprieve so that would give time for Congress to act or for reviews to take place. You know, Congress could have acted 4 years ago when this was initially brought up with the ICJ. And all this is an effort for lawyers who are coming back after the fact, who never brought up the fact that he was a foreign national in his direct appeals, to throw something against the wall and see if it'll stick.
Allison Castle again with Governor Perry. Dave Montgomery still with us with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Are Texas politics involved in this to some extent?
That question's been raised. I don't really see it that much. There's nobody running on this issue. Perry and Governor President Bush have get along well. So, and I'm not sure if there have been any contacts between President Bush and Governor Perry on this issue as of today. But the short answer is I don't really see it.
Back to Allison Castle, have there been personal contacts between the governor and the former governor on this issue?
There have not been, but I'll tell you this is certainly not a case of politics. This is a matter of law. This is a matter of justice.
The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles denied Medellin's request for the execution or the postponement yesterday, as I understand it. The governor does have a possibility for a 30-day reprieve if he chooses to impose it, and the U.S. Supreme Court gets an automatic appeal before the execution occurs tonight. Ms. Castle, do you anticipate anything changing the situation? Is Mr. Medellin pretty certain in your mind then to be executed today?
Well, the governor will make a final decision later today, but I will tell you that he's considering the facts in this case, and the facts are very vicious and cold-blooded. And he'll consider the facts in the case, but he'll make a final decision later today.
And he's not going to be distracted, according to what you've said today, by these concerns about international law.
No, and like I said, Americans abroad are safe. We do provide consular notification, but it is the responsibility of the individual who's arrested to notify the authorities that they are a foreign national.
Allison Castle, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Spokesperson for the governor of Texas, Rick Perry. Edward Swain is a law professor. He's focused on international law and foreign relations at George Washington University. We have a couple of minutes before we go to a break. And Mr. Swain, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
If you can, tell us as briefly as possible what you think the international implications of this might be.
Well, the international implications are potentially somewhat profound. Obviously, the U.S. has been fighting a losing battle in this particular case for some period of time now, and in general in relation to the Vienna Convention for about 10 years. But I think the international community would react rather badly to an execution, and I think it would affect the U.S.'s long-term international legal equities.
What do you mean by react badly?
Well, I believe many in the international scene are quite sophisticated about the U.S. legal and political system, and I think they understood following the Supreme Court's decision that the door was open to an execution. But I think there was hope that Congress would intervene or Texas would relent once it had secured its sort of sovereign right to do otherwise, much as Oklahoma has done. And so I think those concerned about the death penalty and those concerned about U.S. compliance with the orders from international legal institutions will be rightly upset if Texas proceeds.
So does this then have a lot to do with international opposition to the death penalty per se, rather than just the issue of consular notification?
I think that the legal issues have almost solely to do with consular notification and the U.S.'s obligations. I think attention is focused on the case because of the death penalty's involvement, and certainly a number of people have lent their efforts to the legal arguments as a result of that opposition. But I don't think that has clouded the ICJ's judgment in this matter.
Edward Swain, once again, a law professor who studies international law and foreign relations at George Washington University. We're going to take, as I indicated, a brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation on our reporter's notebook. A little bit later, we'll talk about the lowland gorilla may not be facing extinction after all, at least not as soon as had been thought. We'll hear about the discovery of a healthy new population in part of West Africa. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, we're now back with To the Point. Once again, talking about Jose Medellin, scheduled to be executed tonight in Texas for a murder committed 15 years ago. He is a Mexican national, says that he was not given notice that he was entitled to go to the Mexican consul when he was arrested, as he is entitled to do under international treaty. President Bush asked the governor of Texas to postpone the execution until a hearing can be held by virtue of an order of the World Court. Texas says no. The U.S. Supreme Court says that the president overstepped his authority in doing that. Nonetheless, he's continued his request along with the Secretary of State and the Attorney General of the United States. Let me go back to Edward Swain at George Washington University. If the hearing were held, as Mr. Medellin's attorneys are asking, would it make any difference in terms of the death penalty? Would it mean that the sentence had effectively been commuted?
I think it would probably not affect the ultimate outcome. This is something that his attorneys have gotten into in some detail before the U.S. Supreme Court. I think the issue has been that state and federal courts have not previously examined carefully enough whether he was caused prejudice by the failure to notify the Mexican consulate. He was represented by counsel, for example, but there are allegations that counsel was quite incompetent. It spent very little time on the matter, and the Mexican consulate would have come to his assistance. I don't think that it would amount in any event to commuting the death sentence. It would be a question of delay, and that's a perennial issue in these cases. There's the balancing between the administration's in speedy criminal justice and the rights of individual defendants. Here, the additional factor is the national commitment to this treaty obligation.
Edward Swain at George Washington University. Richard Samp, we haven't heard from as yet. He is chief counsel at the Washington Legal Foundation, and he represents the parents of Jenny Ertman, who is one of the victims in this case. Richard Samp, good to have you on our program.
My pleasure.
What do you say to what we just heard, that it wouldn't affect the ultimate outcome? He would, in fact, very likely be executed by the state of Texas. Why not then go ahead and have the governor of Texas delay the execution long enough for these international issues to be resolved?
Well, I think Professor Swain just said it very well. It's now been 15 years since the murder, and in fact, the Texas courts did address the issue of whether he had been prejudiced and determined that no, he had not been. And the only argument now is, well, maybe they ought to take another look at it and look at it more completely. But given that it's already been looked at, I think Texas is well in its rights in determining that, any further delay far outweighs the possibility that new evidence of prejudice could be shown up. However, I think it's worth noting that Texas just yesterday made a filing in the Supreme Court in which it said that we are quite willing, in the cases of all the other people on death row who are facing similar issues, to allow the issue of prejudice to be addressed. It's only because of the extreme delay in this particular case, plus the fact that the issue has already been addressed, that it doesn't feel the need to look at the issue again.
Yeah, it's already been addressed, but by the Texas court, not by the World Court or the courts of the United States.
Well, no, I think what the World Court said was, it said generically in 51 cases, you ought to look at the issue of prejudice. It's important to note that neither Medellin nor Texas was a party before the International Court of Justice,
okay.
And had they been, Texas could have pointed out, we already looked at this issue, so there's no reason to order us to look at it again in the case of Medellin, and perhaps they would have been persuaded by that. And I think that points out one of the major problems here, is that because Texas is not a party to the case in the World Court, because Medellin is not a party to the case in the World Court, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to talk about any obligation they have to follow a court decision in a case in which they were not a party.
So Mexico was the moving party before the World Court, is that right?
Yes. The two parties were the United States and Mexico, and the United States was ordered to do its best to get Texas to take another look at this issue. The main reaction of the United States to that was to say, clearly the World Court has misinterpreted the treaty, therefore we withdraw from World Court jurisdiction. So this kind of issue can never arise again because both the federal government, the executive branch, and the Supreme Court have agreed that this is a gross mischaracterization of the treaty. Nonetheless, the United States recognizes its obligation to try to do its best to comply with a particular order that came out 4 years ago, and they are doing their best. But Texas is not a party and therefore is not bound.
Richard Samp, again, representing the parents of Jenny Ertman, one of the victims in this crime, chief counsel for the Washington Legal Foundation. Back to David Fati, director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. If Texas has now said that it would, in the cases of all the 50 other Mexican defendants that are in the same situation as Mr. Medellin, allow hearings to go forward, does that take care of the problem?
Well, I am not familiar with the filing that Mr. Samp mentioned. It may well, because as he correctly pointed out, the order from the World Court simply directs the United States to provide review and reconsideration of these death sentences. So it may resolve the problem going forward, but it certainly does not resolve the problem in the case of Mr. Medellin. Let me just point out the irony here, that the U.S. was instrumental in establishing the World Court right after World War II, and ever since then has worked to build a world in which countries obey international law and honor the commitments they make to other nations. In fact, the U.S. went to the World Court in 1980, after Iran had seized American hostages at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. And now we're in a situation where the U.S. is about to execute a foreign citizen in what everyone except the governor of Texas agrees would be a clear violation of international law. And that's a very unfortunate situation that will almost certainly have severely negative consequences for the U.S. in the future.
What about the argument we heard from Allison Castle, the representative of Governor Perry's office, that in fact this had been through the legal system very extensively? Mr. Samp just said the same thing, that it had been adjudicated. The state of Texas had found that he wasn't in fact denied his anything as a result of not getting the privilege of going to the consul. And it took so many years before his attorneys ever brought it up.
Well, again, I am not familiar with the details of the procedural history of this case, but although Texas was not represented before the World Court, because the World Court only hears cases brought between nations, the United States was, and I assure you, the United States very vigorously defended the convictions and the death sentences of Mr. Medellin and the other 50 Mexican nationals. So to suggest that these arguments were somehow not presented to the World Court is simply incorrect. And I should point out that yesterday in the Los Angeles Times, Jeffrey Davidow, the former U.S. ambassador to Mexico, said that this is a treaty, the Vienna Convention, that has allowed U.S. diplomats to save hundreds, if not thousands, of American lives. And he warns that a U.S. failure to comply with treaty obligations in this case would significantly impair the ability to protect Americans in the future. Now, this is a former U.S. ambassador to Mexico.
Richard Samp, back to you again at the Washington Legal Foundation, representing the parents of one of the victims here. What about those kinds of concerns? You're not in a position, obviously, to allow a delay here, but you would. You are an effective representative on one side of the case. Why not ask or allow the governor to go ahead, or even appeal to the governor to go ahead, as long as it doesn't threaten the possibility that Mr. Medellin will finally get the ultimate punishment from the state of Texas?
Well, the best way to make sure that other countries comply with their consular notification procedures is to do so ourselves. We ought to be complying with the Vienna Convention, and in fact, both the state of Texas and the United States government have been doing great educational efforts to try to increase compliance. Yes, it's unfortunate that in this case and in thousands of other cases back in the 1980s and 90s, there was not compliance, and we ought to do more to comply. But that issue of that past violation has nothing to do with whether or not Mr. Medellin got a fair trial and deserves to die. The Texas court said, yes, despite that violation, he does deserve to die.
But apparently the timing of his execution does have something to do with what happens in other countries, their view of the United States, and whether or not it meets its obligations.
As I said, their violation took place 15 years ago. The best way for us to comply and to get them to comply is to educate local law enforcement people and to make sure that they comply in the future. But any objection to the execution has much more to do with European elites who are opposed to the death penalty generally rather than the overall U.S. record of compliance with the treaty, which is really quite good.
Mr. Fatih, with the Human Rights Watch, what about that, to the issue of the death penalty per se? I don't think we've heard from you on that issue. Is that really what a lot of people are concerned about here?
Well, I agree with Professor Swain that certainly everyone is aware that this case involves the death penalty, and everyone is aware that the United States is an outlier compared to the rest of the democratic world in its retention and enthusiastic use of the death penalty. But I think Professor Swain is correct that this case is first and foremost about an admitted treaty violation committed by the United States and an order from a court whose jurisdiction the United States has accepted. And it will not be long before the shoe is on the other foot, and U.S. citizens will be facing execution or imprisonment abroad. And if this execution goes forward in what the U.S. government admits would be a violation of international law, the U.S. will be very hard-pressed to then insist that other countries honor their obligations under international law.
So, Edward Swain, back to you. Again, many ironies here, but is it the very fact that the U.S. does try to abide by this treaty something that's making it even more difficult for the United States in this particular case?
Well, the United States is trying to do two things. One, it has vigorously tried to defend Texas's interests before the ICJ, and now on the home front, faced with an adverse decision by the ICJ, it's trying to get Texas to comply.
So, excuse me, just the ICJ is the International Court of Justice, also called the World Court. Go ahead.
That's right, I apologize.
That's right.
And so it's been fighting essentially this two-front battle, but matters have decisively gone on to the home front. And there, the United States, not simply Texas, has to take the long view. And part of that long view is a desire to promote its reputation for complying with international obligations, a desire to promote the interests of United States citizens in similar positions abroad, where we may not always have Texas's attentions to detail, and we may have U.S. citizens facing trumped-up charges. And so I think we have a great deal at stake in the U.S. commitment to international law and institutions, and we need to preserve the moral and legal capital to say to other states, if they attempt to defy an international court of justice or another international tribunal order, you can't do that, and not have it be pointed out to us that we have ourselves recently violated an order. If I could say one thing about whether Texas has already essentially complied with the ICJ order, I think that's pretty plainly not the case. And no court has said that, nor has the U.S. executive branch said that. The problem has been that Texas has always contemplated the question of prejudice to Mr. Medellin in the context of whether it raises a constitutional violation. It has not examined it simply on its face to see whether the trial was affected short of establishing a constitutional violation. It could have done that quite a long time ago, so I don't think it's entirely fair to say the delay is all Mr. Medellin's fault.
Before we run out of time, let me ask you another kind of question, and that is this. You mentioned the battle on the home front. We've talked a little bit about the death penalty, which is supported in this country but not in other countries necessarily. What about illegal immigration, the fact that Mr. Medellin is a Mexican national. I don't know that he's an undocumented immigrant, but it does appear that he is. And I'm just wondering, in your discussions with people of this case, particularly people in Texas, has that issue arisen?
It always seems to come up. I think the question, it's an odd question to arise because the predicate for him having any rights is that he be an alien, whether he's illegal or otherwise. And so when Ms. Castle said earlier that Texas, in its defense, says, we don't care where you're from, well, the problem is it precisely does matter where you are from. Aliens have rights under U.S. treaties that U.S. citizens do not, and it's precisely because the U.S. is concerned about the fate of its citizens overseas. And so I think that's why we need to pay special attention to this kind of case, as opposed to treating it as though he were not an alien at all.
From a political standpoint, though, if you're the chief executive in charge and you're dealing with both the death penalty and illegal immigration, which are big issues and certainly big issues in Texas, doesn't that provide a sort of added set of pressures?
I think it probably does, and I think that may explain the kind of comment like, we don't care where you're from. I think it's unfortunate. Illegal immigration per se is not at issue here, only whether he is a national of another state. And I think, as I said, that requires special attention to his circumstances, which, as you say, runs contrary somewhat to the political impulse of the times.
If he were to be executed tonight as scheduled or at some time in the near future, does that end the matter for the World Court, given what we heard earlier from Mr. Samp, that Texas says it's willing to go ahead with hearings in these other cases?
Well, it doesn't really end things before the ICJ, because other individuals are subject to the Avena decision. Now, Texas has pledged to afford everyone other than Medellin, as I understand it, review and reconsideration. But I think that pledge has to be understood in light of what they're now saying about whether Medellin's prior review and reconsideration was already sufficient. They seem to be, I think, urging a kind of review and reconsideration that's short of what the World Court has already required. So I think they will probably continue to fall somewhat short of the mark. Of course, there are foreign nationals in similar situations who are not part of this class, who may be, for example, nationals of other states. It's my understanding that there's a Honduran who's scheduled for execution in Texas quite soon. He is not affected by the Avena judgment, but he raises very similar treaty issues.
Richard Sam, back to you with the Washington Legal Foundation representing the parents of one of the victims in the Medellin case. What do you say to that? Is it possible that this won't meet the standard asked by the World Court?
Well, the World Court never really set any standard other than to say take another look at it. So given that the World Court no longer has jurisdiction over this case because the United States has said it's withdrawing all jurisdiction for the future, I don't see this becoming an issue again. Certainly a Honduran has no right to raise these issues with the World Court because, again, jurisdiction has been withdrawn. And the only question in terms of whether the United States has complied is, did the United States try to do enough to convince Texas to go along? And the only thing that can happen now is that Mexico could bring the issue before the Security Council of the UN and say they're failing to comply with a court decision. And everything I've seen from the Bush administration shows that they are making best efforts to comply.
And David Fatih with Human Rights Watch, what do you think will be the consequences immediately if, in fact, Mr. Medellin is executed tonight or in days to come?
Well, that's difficult to tell. There could be various negative consequences for U.S. Individual citizens abroad, as well as U.S. businesses that rely on the U.S. reputation for compliance with international law in their international business dealings. I'd like to point out that, you know, the U.S. is not at all unique in having both a federal government and state governments. Many other countries have a similar structure. Canada and Mexico are two. Germany is another one. And to my knowledge, it's never been argued before that states or provinces are free to simply ignore treaty obligations that have been taken on by their national government. So I think that this is why the Bush administration has quite consistently and quite correctly recognized that the United States as a whole is responsible for for the behavior of its constituent states.
Well, thank you all very much for being with us. David Fatih with Human Rights Watch, Richard Samp with the Washington Legal Foundation, Edward Swain at George Washington University, and our earlier guests, Allison Castle, spokeswoman for the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, and Dave Montgomery with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. We'll, of course, see what happens tonight to Mr. Medellin. Based on estimates made in the 1980s, scientists have believed that the lowland gorillas of Western Africa were facing extinction. Today, some better news. What one conservationist calls the mother lode of gorillas has been found in the Republic of Congo. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. The lowland gorilla population was thought to be less than 100,000, severely threatened by disease and hunting. But more than 125 lowland gorillas have been found alive and well in a remote, inaccessible region of the Republic of Congo. It's called the Green Abyss. Emma Stokes was there for the Wildlife Conservation Society. She's now in Edinburgh, Scotland, at the International Primatological Society Congress. And Emma Stokes, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks.
Describe, if you will, what you discovered in this part of the Republic of Congo, not the Democratic Republic of Congo. That's a different country.
Right.
This is a smaller one. Tell us what you saw.
Well, so what we're presenting at this Congress is the results of three large surveys that we conducted in the north of this country in 2006 and 2007. And the surveys were for trying to find out the abundance of great apes in this region. And what we came up with was an estimate of approximately 125,000 gorillas inhabiting this area of about 47,000 square kilometers. I think that's about 18 or 19,000 square miles.
How do you count gorillas?
Well, it's tricky. You can't actually count individual gorillas, believe it or not. These are dense forests, and it's actually very difficult to see gorillas in the forests. They're quite secretive animals, and they often flee on sight. So instead of counting gorillas, what we do is we count the signs that they leave behind. So every day, gorillas make night nests to sleep in by bending branches and leaves. And these leave quite an obvious calling card in the forest. So when researchers are trying to count numbers, they follow survey lines and count the nests that the gorillas leave behind. And then from the number of nests that we count, we can try and work out how many gorillas are in the forest.
But you're confident in this figure of 125,000?
Yeah, we're pretty confident in that. I mean, there was a very, very high nest density, and in converting that to numbers of gorillas, we're fairly confident that, we've got these very high numbers.
What has been so threatening to, not just threatening, but what has wiped out so many other lowland gorillas, and how do you think it is that this population has managed to escape it?
Yeah, I mean, Western lowland gorillas have received quite a lot of press in the last kind of 12 months. They were recently upgraded to critically endangered on the IUCN red listing of threatened species. And this is largely due to two main things. Firstly, commercial hunting for bushmeat for food. And secondly, disease, and specifically Ebola, the Ebola hemorrhagic fever. So, and this is very high mortality in gorillas and is known to have decimated populations elsewhere in northern Congo and also in neighboring Gabon. So the results of our survey, first of all, indicated that up until now, this area we surveyed does not seem to have been impacted by Ebola, which is good news. And secondly, it seems to have enjoyed a lot of protection in these areas, which is due to a couple of factors. Firstly, some of these areas are extremely inaccessible and remote. Some of these places are about 80, 90 kilometers from the nearest road or village, and this is where this term green abyss was coined. And secondly, there are some areas which have some more people and some roads and activities, but these places have enjoyed a large amount of anti-poaching or law enforcement to protect gorillas from hunting. So we think that's combination of those factors are the reasons why these populations seem to be in such good shape.
When gorillas, people eat gorillas, do they do it in order to sustain themselves, or is it a particular delicacy?
In this area, local people do not really target gorillas to feed themselves for local consumption. The hunting of gorillas is really to feed kind of urban markets, where it is more considered to be a luxury food item.
Is the Green Abyss, though, from what you're saying, a difficult place to hunt?
Yeah, it's pretty difficult. I mean, this area has got a lot of swamp forest, which makes it extremely inhospitable. So there really are remote places which probably are quite free from human disturbance. And that offers this natural protection for some of these gorilla populations and other wildlife populations.
Again, you say that this population has not been subjected to the Ebola virus. Do you know why?
No, in a word. I mean, there's so many questions that are unanswered with Ebola, and there are some fundamental issues that we're still trying to work out about how Ebola moves through the forest, what provokes particular epidemics, the transmission dynamics of the disease. What we do know is the last recorded outbreaks of Ebola in gorilla populations were right next door to this large population in 2005. And so when we started these surveys, we really weren't sure what we were going to find in those neighboring areas. And given what we know about Ebola and what it's done over the previous 10 years in particular, it's extremely likely that this could pop up in this large population in the coming years. And so whilst this is good news for the moment with these gorilla populations, you know, we really can't afford to be complacent, and we need to start being very proactive in coming up with measures to potentially control Ebola and at least to understand how Ebola might be acting on these populations.
So you don't think these gorillas have some sort of genetic predisposition to not being affected by the Ebola virus? You think they just haven't encountered it?
Yeah, I believe that's the case. I mean, from what we know about Ebola, it strikes up, it's very localized, it can have a very quick and catastrophic impact in places that previously had very high gorilla numbers. And in fact, places with higher gorilla numbers seem to be more susceptible. We believe this really represents a real future potential threat, and we need to be proactive in addressing these issues.
Why do you think it is that people are so interested in gorillas?
I don't know. It's it seems to be the species that attracts so much attention. I don't know. I mean, maybe from there's some kind of human, some way of identifying with these animals, and they've been portrayed in the media and a lot in various different ways. And I don't know. There's something kind of the sheer size and I don't know. There's something pretty overwhelming and incredible about gorillas.
They look sort of familiar.
I guess, yeah. In a way, they do, yeah.
One more question, which I haven't got to. What about logging in this area? It sounds like it would be a difficult place to log. I know that's been a problem elsewhere.
Yeah, actually, there's a lot of logging in this area. Mm. In fact, the majority of the area we surveyed is probably locked up in active logging concessions. There are two important protected areas in this survey area, but the majority of grade 8 habitat lies outside in logging concessions. And this is like a real big issue in the reality of doing conservation in this part of the world. And so our philosophy on this is to try and engage those logging companies to work with organizations like Wildlife Conservation Society and the government of Congo in implementing effective measures to protect great apes and other wildlife in their logging concessions. And this goes hand in hand with the process of certification or green labeling of wood in these concessions. And we've successfully implemented this in a number of concessions around the Nuwabali Ndoki National Park in collaboration with a logging company called CIB. And actually, in those concessions where these anti-poaching measures had been successfully implemented, we found that these concessions were supporting very high gorilla densities.
Well, congratulations for that. Emma Stokes with the Wildlife Conservation Society speaking to us from the International Primatological Society Congress in Edinburgh. Thanks so much for being with us.
All right. Thank you.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Carolyn Ranziner and Dan Konecki. Our technical director is Charlton Thorpe. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.